What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink. We engage you, the listener, and interact on a different topic each week. We've got loads of good tunes, lovely music, and lots of analysis to keep you going.
And interviews from experts or you young people telling us what you think about our daily topic.
That's always the best part of the show, Jackson, to hear what the listeners have to say. There's always lots of juicy comments and lots of different perspectives. Absolutely,
so stay tuned. Yeah. 20 years ago, the world was witness to a horrific event that claimed the lives of almost a million people. We are talking about the Rwanda genocide, in which extremist Hutu elements, supported by the government of the time, undertook a mass campaign to exterminate the minority Tutsi and moderate Hutus. The killings lasted 100 days and at the end left thousands dead and the society broken. Even though the killings were carried out by Rwandans themselves, many analysts and world leaders have said that the international community is guilty of not acting enough to stop the killings. Specifically, the UN, which at the time had a peacekeeping force in Rwanda, has been accused of not protecting the victims from their killers. In fact, in some cases, people fleeing the killings, running for their lives and sought the protection of the UN force were turned away. Today, millions live with the legacy and scars of this painful episode in human history. Those that survived live with both physical and psychological scars that no amount of time can heal. But many that we have spoken to choose to live on, to keep on, to forgive, and many cases reconcile with those that committed the most horrific acts of violence on them and their loved ones. This week's commemoration of 20 years after the genocide in Rwanda was for many a celebration of how far the country and its people have come. Observers point to a very interesting statistic about the country. More than half of the country's population was born after 1994. Those are the future of a nation that seeks to move forward from a troubled past. So today on the show, as we remember what happened 20 years ago, we want to ask the question, what lessons has the world learned from Rwanda? What is the role of the youth in forging a future where such atrocities are never repeated? Let's talk. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Other countries in Africa can learn a lot from the Rwandan genocide that took place in 1994. The first lesson is that the warring side resolved their differences amicably, whereby people understood each other and they resolved the war. But before resolving the war, we had some refugees going to other countries. So there are other existing in those countries until now. But we hear that in Rwanda there is peace now, and we have heard that they are about to celebrate 20 years of peace. Some countries who are maybe at war this time around can learn from Rwanda genocide the issue of solving war amicably, that is involving third party or arbitration, use of arbitration in resolving conflicts.
Rwanda has shown a very good example to other African nations. It has shown an official way of resolving conflicts, especially ethnic conflicts. And this should be a lesson to Sudan. That's an example. Yes, because we always hear Sudan, South Sudan and Sudan having conflicts. They are ethnic or conflicts because it is one nation, we know. So it should be a lesson to Sudan.
We want a revolution. nation and learn what they are doing. It will open your eyes to the people.
Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Today on the show, we join the people of Rwanda and the world to commemorate and remember the hundreds of thousands of lives lost during the Rwandan genocide in 1994. To many survivors, the pain of loss still persists. It's something that changed the face of the country and changed the lives of so many people forever. Many people lived the nightmare of the 100 days that would change the face of a nation. But as many have said, there is hope that humanity learned a lesson, that what took place in Rwanda will never happen again. Must never happen again.
One of the people that survive the genocide and live with the scars, both psychological and physical, is Consuelo Nishime, who recently wrote a book detailing her experience during and after the genocide. I reached her in San Francisco, and she took us back 20 years ago, what happened to her.
Yeah, what happened 1994, you know, since April, it was a terrible genocide. I was 14 years old, and I was very young to understand very much, you know, that what was happening, it was very tragic. So I was forced myself and my family to go into hiding, like okay. many other Tutsis in the country. Yes.
Did you have an understanding of what was happening around you?
Around me, I was just watching people, you know, having machetes and all different tools, you know, going around and to kill people, and especially, of course, the Tutsis.
Right.
And in my area, it was very, very terrifying that to see everywhere the houses burning, you know, in the hills. So,
did you understand that there were Hutus that were coming after you as a Tutsi?
I understood that because I've heard it on the radio so far. I've heard it many times on the radio that, you know, we were going to be killed. So already I understood that I am going to be killed because I was a Tutsi. So,
okay.
And I was hearing around everywhere. So, and even the neighbors and all, everyone was saying that you will be killed. So you have to go to hide. So
did your parents ever talk to you about it, prepare you in a way of what was going to happen or what was coming?
Not at all. Actually, that's not the conversation we had at all. So we didn't have that conversation. It was something that I was hearing myself, on the radio, because it was on the radio. But
okay.
Other than that, we didn't have any conversation in the house about it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about your family. How many were you in the family?
I had my both parents who were teachers, and I was the oldest, 14 years old, my younger sister, and my three brothers who were from 9 years old to 18 months old. Yes.
And did how many of you guys were able to survive the genocide?
It was me and my sister and my mom. So, and the rest were killed. My father was killed early April 15th, and my three brothers were killed on May 9th, yes.
Now, your brothers were really young.
They were very, very young, and from age 9, 7, and almost 18 months old. And it was very, it was very, very difficult during that time, so we had to hide from a place to another, and difficult circumstances. And
at what point were you did you separate from the family? At what point did was your father taken or your brothers taken?
The way it happened, my father, actually the killers found us where we're hiding, and then we these people took us in the ceiling in the house, and my father was followed by other killers because he was trying not to be together with us at that time.
Okay.
And because we're trying to not be in the same place, because, you know, to try to manage not to be in the same place. And these killers followed him. So later on in the evening, while we're hiding in the ceiling, that's when I heard them saying that they have killed him. So
you were hiding in the ceiling of your house?
No, it was a ceiling of a neighbor, actually someone who took us in their ceiling in the house in a neighbor, so neighborhood.
But they found out that you were hiding in there.
Yeah, we were hiding over there. So there was no other place for them to hide us because everywhere they were, these killers were searching everywhere. So the only place they can find is, you know, up in the ceiling in the house. So that's, even though it was very, very hard to go there, but we managed to go there and sit over there. So we can hear everything. People are talking outside, and that's how I heard that my father was killed.
That is Konsole Nishimwe. We'll hear more of our conversation later on in the show. But first, let's hear what you have to say about our topic today. What is it that you feel that the world has learned, or your society has learned, from the genocide that happened in Rwanda 20 years ago?
I'm called Deo Juba Town. The genocide of Rwanda, it brings a lot of sad memories. But live along the sad memories, where the Rwanda is now, it has taught us a lot of lessons. You know, forgiveness is the key of everything to register success.
I'm calling Zabu, a Ugandan by nationality, and a Langi from Northern Uganda. All I can learn from the 1994 Rwandan genocide, first of all, I learned to have nationalism in me, as in to love my country. Because as we are to give like the examples of those people who fought, those who fought to prevent the Rwandan genocide, they did it all because of the love of the country that they had in them. Another thing I can learn from the Rwandan genocide is to have unity among each other. Because one of the causes of the Rwandan genocide was discrimination. Like you give an example, the Hutu and the Tutsi weren't together. They were discriminating the Tutsi, which is not good. I just learn like to love one another and have unity.
I am Juliet, and I'm South Sudanese. The Rwandan massacre was a very short one, and a lot of people lost their lives. It was also between tribes. But when you consider what this nation is going through, we've had our war for so long, and it has not been simply a tribalistic war. We have a lot of things we are fighting for. Earlier, it was to separate this country from the northern part to be independent. Now, we are facing it as the southerners. It's southerners against southerners.
Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi here in Washington, D.C. Nadia Sam is in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, we are commemorating the 20-year anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. On the phone with me, I still have Konsole Nishimwe. She's a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. Also, a published author who details the tragic events that led to the loss of members of her family, being attacked during the genocide, and surviving to tell the story. You live with those psychological scars, but you also have physical scars because you were also attacked.
During those times, because of the way we were hiding, it was very, very difficult a lot of times. You know, with these killers, they were finding us, you know, because it was very hard. Sometimes we'd be hiding in the bushes or if we're lucky to find someone to hide us, we'll go there. Sometimes you don't know if someone was kind. So for me, one time when we were hiding in this place, we were found by the killers. As you know that during the genocide, many women were raped, and that happened to me. I was attacked by this neighbor, someone I've known for many years, and he beat me with a sword, and was raped by him. So, and it was very, he thought maybe other people would kill me because he didn't, leave. He left me there, so he thought other people would kill me. Actually, so
okay. But, so he left you physically bruised and broken, but he also left you with something else that you're living with.
Yes, later on, I found out because of that. I found out that as a result, I contracted HIV. So that was another pain to live with. So it was very hard for me. So
It's been 20 years now. We are commemorating the 20-year anniversary of the genocide. How hard has it been for you to share the story, and does it get easier over time?
It depends on the moment. It has taken me a long, many, many years to be able to actually talk about it because I went through a lot of trauma myself, even to have nightmares and all images coming to my mind. So I avoided many, many times to even talk about it. But it wasn't helping at all. So by the time I was able to talk about it, gradually even deciding to start writing about it, it became almost like a therapy for me. So I had to relieve a lot of things, and then I realized that it was helping me somehow, to be able to express what I went through. So
You did write a book. You wrote a book titled "Tested to the Limit: A Genocide Survivor's Story of Pain, Resilience, and Hope." What does it mean to you that people get to learn about your story and for you to be able to speak about it or write about it?
My book, it really shows a lot of details of what I went through with my family during that time. Like many, many things happened. I did tell a lot because it was like I had to relieve so many things. So it will show that what we went through as people, and also my journey to be where I am, to be able to talk about it as well. So
The people around you, how has it, family network, your friend network, helped you to deal with what you went through?
I try myself to be able to surround myself, of course, with people that have helped me so far. And I've been so blessed, to be able to find, especially some survivors and also friends I found here in the U.S. to help me. So, we talk about different things and positive things and be able to encourage ourselves not to go to hate those people who have hurt us, because that's not my message. My message is not to hate those people who have hurt us. It's just to actually, how can we help heal ourselves and have hope and not be, hateful. So,
Consolé, thank you very much. Consolé is the author of Tested to the Limit, A Genocide Survivor's Story of Pain, Resilience, and Hope. Consolé, we thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
All right.
What would I do without your smart mouth? Drawing me in and you kicking me out. You've got my head spinning, no kidding, I can't pin you down. What's going on in that beautiful mind? I'm on your magical mystery ride, and I'm so dizzy, don't know what hit me, but I'll be alright. My head's underwater, but I'm breathing.
Today on the show, we pay tribute to the thousands who lost their lives during the Rwandan genocide. Never again. That's what world leaders declared after the Holocaust. Yet tragically, in Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur, millions of people lost their lives, lost their families, or were forced to flee their homes. Life as they knew it changed forever. History doesn't have to keep repeating itself.
Now, for any society to be able to move past a tragic event like the Rwandan genocide, there has to be forgiveness by the victims for those that committed crimes against their humanity, the killers, the perpetrators. And since you live with them on a daily basis in your community, in your society, whether they're in jail, whether they're out of jail, many say that there's a need to move past, to forgive, and that helps in the healing process for society as a whole. One of the survivors of the Rwandan genocide who has lived to tell her story is Jacqueline Murekatete. She lost many members of her family, her friends and her neighbors. Asked her about how one is able to forgive people who committed such horrendous acts of violence on her family.
You know, I think forgiveness, you know, means a lot of things to different people. I think that, you know, it's an individual thing. So there's nothing, like, I don't think there's a general meaning that, you know, should be prescribed for all people. I think it's something that each of us has to come to terms with and make decision about. So for me, personally, and I always talk about forgiveness generally in a context of, you know, my experience. During the genocide against Tutsi in Rwanda. And for me, forgiveness in that context means that, you know, despite what I went through in the genocide, despite what was taken from me, forgiveness means really finding the courage to move forward with my life in a way that is, you know, without anger and bitterness and feelings of revenge. So being able to move forward.
Moving past the pain that has been inflicted upon you, whether it's physical or mental. Does it also mean exonerating the other person who has impacted you this terribly?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think for me, forgiveness, you know, I've met and spoken to survivors who, you know, understand forgiveness to mean, you know, let's say going to people who killed their families and saying, you know, I forgive you, whether they ask for it or not, or when they do ask to say, I forgive you. But for me, I don't think it's my position to, or it's my right to forgive people who killed my family, in a sense, to go and say, I forgive you. I think that's really between them and God. Because especially in Rwanda, forgiveness has become a very complicated concept, because a lot of people were asked to forgive, and a lot of people asked for forgiveness, not necessarily because they, you know, felt guilty or regretful they had done, but because they felt like they had to ask for forgiveness. So a lot of the asking wasn't really heartfelt. It's just some people did it because they felt like they have to, or because they could, you know, if they asked forgiveness and admit what they did, they could get, you know, lower sentences and get jailed.
We cannot overstate the role of youth in rebuilding a post-genocide, post-conflict society like Rwanda. And 20 years later, statistics show that nearly half of the total population was born after the genocide or are under 20 years old. And that's the generation that the country is looking up to forge a new path where ethnicity is not the primary advent fire. Michelle Busa is a young graduate student from Rwanda going to school here in Virginia. She was just but a kid when the genocide was taking place 20 years ago. I reached her just as she was walking out of class. Michelle says that she has spoken to many young people who embrace the challenge of rebuilding their society.
So I want to say I've interacted with some who are under 20, some of them who are very much aware of what happened, and some of them who are not aware when I say not aware, who don't understand, the history and the events that culminated to the genocide. But for those who actually are aware, again, this all is because the story was being communicated to them, and also the frequency of how the story was being communicated to them.
You mean by their parents?
By their parents and other family members, definitely. But now we're starting to see much more of an awareness all over, not just in Rwanda, all over the world.
Okay.
We're starting to see even young Rwandans who are under 20 becoming more aware of what happened, and who are writing poems and books and are curious of what's going on. And so it's always a good beginning, and I think this is going to continue.
But do you see young people playing a role in forging a new path for the country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so young people, I think, are. I'm seeing it already. As I mentioned, one was already them being very aware of what's going on, and some of them are writing books and are having different presentations all over, like different schools, explaining to others about what happened, which is one part of the awareness.
Right.
But in terms of development, I also want to make sure we're clear with young people, because we tend to put, lump a lot of young people into a certain age group, but people who are say 15 to 20 are different, going through a different experience than those who are 20 to 25, and those who are 25 to 30, and 30 to 35, but what I would say for anyone in that age group is that some of them are already engaging in development works, but I would probably say I would consider also seeing more of youth being more engaged and more curious about what's going on. Most importantly, though, they need to interact more with older generation moving forward.
Okay.
And that way there can be a transfer of knowledge, too. And I think this is already happening. Again, it's a gradual process, but that's where I see the youth taking part. There's definitely a need for more interaction.
And when you're talking about interaction, this is interaction between the young and old, not between the different ethnic groups in the country.
No, there's nothing to do with ethnic groups. And again, there's an initiative actually currently going on known as Ndino Munyarwanda. And each and everyone is definitely identifying themselves as a Rwandan, and they are all acknowledging that.
And you feel that because of the unique experience that the country went through, that in a better place to understand some of these things, they've lived through them, they experience them on a daily basis.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I would like to thank my co-host Nadia Sam in Johannesburg, South Africa. We would also like to thank all our listeners who contributed to the show this time around. And if you have any questions or comments or want to contribute to the show in future, remember to send us an email at upfront@voanews.com. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, my handle is @UpfrontAfrica. Let's connect again next week, right here, same time. On behalf of my colleague Nadia Sami, my name is Jackson.